With everything you have on your plate, earning your degree online seems impossible. But at Grand Canyon University, we specialize in helping you fit a master's degree in education into your busy day. Your graduation team, led by your own GCU counselor, provides you with the personal support you need to succeed. Achieve your goals with a plan and team behind you. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Visit gcu.edu.
Hello and welcome to another World War II podcast. I'm Angus Wallace. I have a great episode for you. We'll be discussing Case Red, the German attack on France post-Dunkirk. Often when we talk about the Battle for France, the history seems to stop at Dunkirk. In actual fact, the fighting carried on for a few more weeks. There were still 100,000 plus British troops in France post-Dunkirk, and Churchill was keen to keep the French fighting. Joining me is Robert Forsyk. If you recall, last year we discussed Operation Sea Lion with Bob. Well, he's been beavering away this last year and has a new book out called Case Red, The Collapse of France. It's a real eye-opener. If you enjoy this episode, I can tell you now, there is more. Patrons of the show get access to extra bits of World War II chat, things that might have ended up on the cutting room floor because it was off topic. If you have room in your life for more World War II chat, you can become a patron by making a small recurring donation by PayPal. For more information, go to www.2podcast.com/donate, or you can sign up to become a patron via Patreon at patreon.com/ww2podcast. A dollar or a pound each month from enough of you guys goes a long way to helping me find the time and pay for putting the podcast together. And I thank those loyal listeners who already support the show. So that's ww2podcast.com/donate or patreon.com/ww2podcast. So Bob, thanks for joining me again. I wonder if our starting point is actually the interwar years, and in your book you tease out some fascinating threads on the interwar French policy on their military spending, and it's not so much its cutbacks, it's just it's spent elsewhere. I wonder if you could sort of elaborate on that.
So every country in the world was affected by the Great Depression in the late 1920s and early 1930s, that it had an effect on every economy. And of course, it forced all countries to have military economies. So nobody was able to build the ideal military force in the 1930s. In the case of France, they were actually less affected than some of the other countries because they decided not to devalue their currency. So that gave them an inflation problem. Their weapons became very expensive overnight, but on the other hand, they still had money. The main issue that usually comes up is spending on the Maginot Line, which was over a period of about 6 years, was roughly 5 billion francs. In the late 1930s, Germany actually spent almost twice this amount on the Westfall. The French were not the only country investing heavily in border fortifications. The problem is because they were defeated, the Maginot Line becomes a symbol of all that was wrong on French defense spending, that they spent on the wrong priority, the wrong place. They should have spent more on tanks and anti-tank weapons and aircraft and things of that sort. There's no doubt that some of that is true. The Maginot Line, in terms of spending, accomplished what it was supposed to do. They wanted to keep the Germans from invading eastern France as they had in the Franco-Prussian War and the First World War. The Germans did not invade eastern France in the Second World War. Even Hitler was very concerned about the Maginot Line. They had an exaggerated idea, thanks to French propaganda, which was very successful in convincing the world that the Maginot Line was much, much stronger than it actually was. The real priority issues for the French were not fortifications. The Maginot Line made sense to a certain extent. The problem is, first of all, they went rather cheap on it. They should have invested more in it and made it longer, stronger, more effective. They basically built an economy-sized Maginot Line. The real issue came in aircraft and the Navy. The French Navy was really unnecessary to deter Germany. Germany was not in any way deterred by new French battleships or cruisers, and the French went on a large naval building spree in the 1930s to keep up with Mussolini's Navy. But it invested far more money in that and new ships and a naval base, Mirz El Kabir in North Africa, than they invested in the Maginot Line. And it was of no value when war actually came. And of course, the personnel and steel that went into building up the French Navy took away from steel and personnel that could be used for the French Army. The French basically had two armies in the 1930s. The Metropolitan Army, made up of draftees, conscripts, not particularly high quality. It was designed to be fleshed out in the event of wartime, but in peacetime it was kept to a reduced rate of equipment and personnel. The real French army was overseas, the colonial army. These units were full strength, officered by experienced men, led by experienced NCOs. The French colonial army during the interwar period actually fought a lot and fought well. It fought in Syria, putting down a major rebellion in North Africa with the Rif War. And at the beginning of the Second World War, the French leaned very heavily on their colonial regulars. These formed the hard kernel of their army, and it was brought back to metropolitan France to build up, buttress, and train the metropolitan force, which was 90% conscript. The British had the same situation. They had a small regular army that had mostly been deployed overseas. These had to be brought back to England to help train the draftees and the conscripts. But the French had to prepare for an all-out conflict with Germany that they had to rely on with their own resources. They hoped to get help from the British, the Belgians, the Dutch, the Poles, the Czechs. Very little of this actually panned out when war actually came. But prior to the war, the hope was that all these other allies would add in significant forces so that the French would not have to bear the entire burden of a ground war with Germany on their own. They were not prepared, based on the expenditures they made before the war, to bear that burden by themselves. My book, Case Red, points out that the French military had not prepared to fight fully a war that was with primarily their own resources. They had hoped too much for a coalition war effort and more time to build up their own resources. The normal theory is that French doctrine was flawed. In fact, the French doctrine that was used in 1940 was not unlike the Allied doctrine that was used in Normandy in 1944. Methodical battle, as the French called it, was about coordinating armor, artillery, infantry, air support to achieve an effect on the battlefield to overwhelm an enemy. The same thing was done in Normandy in 1944. What the French were attempting to do in 1940 on the defense was not a flawed doctrine. The real problem was they did not have enough equipment and their forces came up short. We see this particularly after Dunkirk. Of course, over 200,000 British troops were evacuated from Dunkirk. A lot of people forget that over 100,000 French troops were evacuated from Dunkirk. They were landed mostly at Cherbourg, and the French army quickly tried to rebuild these units. 100,000 troops was more than five divisions. It would have been very handy in the Battle of France. Unfortunately, they had no equipment to give them. In the 3 weeks remaining to the French Third Republic, they were only able to re-equip a very small percentage of these troops, a few thousand, just in time for the final battles. So the real problem here in 1940 for the French was a shortage of equipment. They had not prepared for an all-out ground effort from the beginning, and they really had hoped that they could increase production and not have to face a real test like this until 1941 or 42. Now, the other countries were in the same situation. The British Army could not be re-equipped after Dunkirk for nearly a year, and that included Lend-Lease help from the United States as well. And the Germans, of course, whenever they suffered material losses in the first couple of years of the war, they came up short as well. And the Germans relied very heavily on captured equipment because they simply cannot produce enough tanks, guns, rifles, machine guns, trucks to equip the Wehrmacht. When they invaded the Soviet Union in 1941, parts of the German army were using captured British Bren gun carriers and Lloyd Carden trucks and French Renault trucks because they simply did not have enough equipment to outfit their army.
So how had the Polish campaign affected them prior to the Battle of France? Because that they must have suffered some losses. I mean, the general idea is that they romped across Poland. They must have suffered losses. Were they made good? Did that impact upon their planned invasion of France?
Well, it's interesting you ask that. That's actually my next book project is Case White in the invasion of Poland. German losses in Poland, particularly in terms of tanks, they lost about one quarter of their tanks were damaged or destroyed, which was quite a lot. And they had to make do with hundreds of Czech-made tanks for the invasion of France. Rather ironically, it was thanks to the French help to the Czech government during the 1930s that there were all these Czech tanks existed. The French, of course, had tried to build up France and Poland as allies in the East. They provided them technical assistance and helped them build up their own arms industries. This is, I think, part of the law of unintended consequences, that the French never anticipated that the tanks they helped the Czechs make would be used against them someday. It's did not work out in their favor. But yet, German losses were significant, but the German military was built for short-term conflicts. And even though they suffered significant losses in Poland and later in France, I mean, the Luftwaffe lost well over 1,000 aircraft during the French campaign, which hurt them during the Battle of Britain. They were short roughly 800 aircrew that probably would have made a difference during the Battle of Britain if they had survived. The Wehrmacht was designed for short-term campaigns, hit hard, take the losses, win quick, and then spend a few months repairing and replacing casualties and lost equipment. That worked well up until 1941 in Russia because the campaign there never ended. So they were never able to catch their breath, which they had relied upon in the early campaigns, was that nothing lasted past the point that they could continue. That was a game changer for them. And the French in 1940 lasted 6 weeks, which was the longest that anybody went toe-to-toe with the Germans up until the Soviets. Essentially, every military started the Second World War shorthanded of equipment. Most militaries are in much the same situation today. They're not geared for long-term protracted warfare. That takes years of building up stockpiles before a country really is in a position to fight for more than a few weeks, and that continues today.
It's a huge cost that people won't stomach.
Taxpayers generally don't want to buy stockpiles of artillery ammunition when they don't need them.
Yeah. I mean, I wondered if the British and the French were really, you know, at the start of the war, they were just trying to get the numbers up and get as many people deployed as possible. So they're sort of very much thinking of the First World War and then thinking, as you say, the kit will follow along afterwards.
Yes. Unfortunately, the British did this even more. The the Secretary of War at the time, Korbelisha, he decided that he wanted to ship three of the Territorial Army TA divisions over to France during the winter of 1939-1940 to train over there. They went to France essentially just with rifles, no other equipment. They had very few vehicles either, no anti-tank guns, no anti-aircraft guns, very little equipment. Most of these personnel had not been trained beyond very basic level of training. And once in France, they were assigned mostly line of communication duties, which meant digging ditches and laying barbed wire and things of that sort, not very useful for training for modern warfare. And these three TA divisions were really the only three formations that survived the demise of the original BEF in Belgium. They were the ones behind, back down by the Somme River, that were still intact. Of course, they had almost no capability, and at the last moment, to try and prevent the Germans from reaching the English Channel, the decision was made by Lord Gort to try and position them sort of as blocking forces in the way, which did not block Guderian for more than 24 hours, and unfortunately led to all two of the three divisions being demolished with heavy casualties. In fact, a large portion of the BEF casualties in 1940 came from these three units rather than the regular units, which most of which made it off the beaches in Dunkirk back to England with acceptable levels of casualties. But the three TA divisions were badly beaten up. One of the brigadier generals, I forget his name, but one of the brigadier generals from one of the TA divisions, when his unit was overrun on, I think it was 20 May, just at the time of the Battle of Abbeville. He was separated from his troops, and he managed to evade and escape, but he never made it back to British lines, and he spent the rest of the war until 1944 in France, disguised, hiding.
Incredible, isn't it, these stories of these
Yes, I'd never heard about that individual before, but I thought that was pretty amusing to hear about a British general hiding in France with the resistance for 4 years until he was rescued.
As you said, the BF sort of is bypassed, and you have these TA units as the backstop. I wonder if the early successes when the breakthrough is happening is down to the better units being up with the BAF. And they're hitting low grade French units, which we don't necessarily hear about when they're romping. When we're only making these initial breakthroughs crossing the Meuse.
Well, of course, the two French divisions, 55th Infantry Division was one of the most prominent, its collapse. So where the Germans chose to make their main effort in 1940 was at Sedan, where the French, by combination of mistakes, bad luck, and error, had placed two of their least capable units, not expecting real trouble here. And their best French units were in Belgium with the BEF. So you had the very best German units supported by virtually the bulk of the Luftwaffe. I think at Sedan, when they made their breakthrough, there was something like 1,000 sorties on the first day of the attack in that sector. So, I mean, crushing level of air support, artillery support. Not unexpectedly, these two reserve divisions broke and fell apart, leading to a tactical defeat, leading to a national-level catastrophe. And that image of those retreating French units has sort of shaped the general perception of the French army in 1940, that they fell apart quickly and did not fight well. The problem is that doesn't fit the rest of the campaign. The French army in Belgium, alongside the British, fought very well. At the Battle of Gembloux Gap in Belgium, the French armored cavalry did exactly what they were expected to do. They moved rapidly into Belgium. They fought a delaying action against two panzer divisions and helped hold the line along the Dyle River until the BEF and the French First Army showed up. They did exactly what they were expected to do. And that defensive line was solid until, of course, it was being outflanked by the German move through the Ardennes and at Sedan. And then in Case Red, I detail all the fighting that happened in France in June 1940, where the initial German attacks, 5-6 June 1940, along the Aisne River and the Somme River, were actually defeated by the French defenses. By that point, the Germans had lost all surprise. There was no fancy maneuvers through the Ardennes at that point. It was a frontal attack. And by this point in the campaign, there were still 100,000 British troops in France after Dunkirk, which is a major point I try and make, particularly for British audiences, that the campaign was not over. There were still 100,000 troops. The RAF still had plenty of squadrons in France. The fighting continued after Dunkirk. Unfortunately, between a combination of Hollywood and mythology, Dunkirk becomes full stop. Battle is over. You know, as Churchill said, the Battle of France is over and the Battle of Britain is about to begin. It sounds great, but that's not actually what happened. And what happened is, Dunkirk was the end of the campaign in Belgium. The invasion of France was about to begin. And that continued for, the rest of June. And the French put up a hard fight and inflicted heavier losses than they actually inflicted earlier in the campaign. Like I say, the Germans had lost the element of surprise. The Germans had a larger numerical advantage at that point. But on the other hand, it was essentially frontal attacks, and the French had some time to get ready. Germans were overrunning Belgium and Dunkirk, the French army was digging in behind rivers. In the 1930s, the French leadership understood what it took to stop a panzer-type attack that the Germans would launch, which was a defense in depth with anti-tank guns, artillery, all-around defense. The British army would employ these kind of tactics later in the desert at Gazala and places like that, in El Alamein with the boxes they built out in the desert, which proved very tough for Rommel's armor to deal with. The French understood this in 1940, but there's a difference between understanding and actually executing. Von Clausewitz said in his theory of war that everything in war is actually easy it's doing it that's hard. There's nothing in war that's rocket science, except, I guess, rocket science. But most of the things, stopping tanks, the French knew. You put anti-tank mines in the ground. You put obstacles out there and cover them with anti-tank guns and automatic weapons. You'll stop the enemy. It's just, the problem was it was not so easy to actually do on the fly, you know, in June 1940, and they ran out of material.
But, you know, I get the feeling, you know, around Dunkirk, the Allies have lost, seemingly have lost the initiative, but there is sort of a, you know, sort of alluded to, a pause here this is where they switch from Case Yellow to Case Red, which is the second half of the Battle of France. Was there anything they could have done to sort of regain the initiative or contain the breakthrough?
The Battle of Abbeville was probably the make or break point there. So while Dunkirk perimeter was being squeezed, there were minimal Allied forces on the Somme, defending the Somme River, but there was an ad hoc British formation known as the Bowman Division, which does not get talked about too much. The 1st Armored Division was also showing up in France as well. And the French had managed to get a few of their better colonial divisions to the Somme River, and eventually de Gaulle's 4th Armored Division. So you had a stream of Allied reinforcements going to the sector, which at the time was only lightly held by a few German divisions. In particular, I make a big point about talking about this one Bavarian division, the 57th Infantry Division from Bavaria, reservists. They were given the mission after Guderian had taken Abbeville. The tanks turned away from southward and turned north to go finish off the Dunkirk perimeter, leaving the bridgeheads they had gained over the Somme held by German reservists. And this was probably a brief opportunity at the end of May and early June 1940 for the Allies to destroy a sizable German force, maybe two divisions. They tried. In the Battle of Abbeville, you see 5 Allied attacks occurring over a period of about 6 days involving the British 1st Armored Division, the 51st Highland Division that was retrieved from the Saar Front, de Gaulle's 4th Armored Division, and several other French divisions. And they did achieve some success against this German reserve division. I don't want to say they came close to recapturing Abbeville, but they reduced the German bridgehead over the Somme in that sector and inflicted considerable losses. The problem was they were not committing the resources they needed, for example, the air support that they needed to really achieve a decisive result. The French did not commit heavy artillery to the sector, which is something they desperately needed. I mean, the French artillery in World War II was actually quite good because it was the same artillery that had helped win on the Western Front in 1918. And artillery doesn't change as much as tanks. The French still had plenty of heavy artillery, but it generally wasn't in the right place at the right time. So they ended up doing these attacks piecemeal over a period of days that instead of achieving a really decisive result, what they achieved was tactical successes, but not leading to a real win. If the Allies had been able to win at Abbeville and crush a few German divisions, I think this would have given Hitler a bit of a pause. He was very concerned during the whole battle that the Allies were going to pull something, an ace out of their sleeve. And he was very concerned that the Allies had more forces than they actually had. He was always very paranoid about something unexpected happening. I mean, he just pulled the unexpected on the Allies with the move through the Ardennes, and he sort of expected that they were going to do something to him unexpected. So I think an unexpected Allied victory would have been helpful. I don't think it would have changed the actual result of the campaign, but it would have slowed the Germans down a little bit and given the Allies a little bit more chance to organize their defenses. However, aside from the French shortage of equipment, the fact is that the RAF failed to commit the resources, even to the British sector that still remained, to ensure air superiority over the British divisions that were still in France. A lot of this is due to Dowding's insistence with Churchill that a large part of the RAF, and particularly all the Spitfires, be kept back in England, you know, to prevent German air raids, which were not occurring at this point. And Dowding, of course, had an important point. He understood that after France fell, that Britain was next. But the Luftwaffe was losing aircraft by the dozens over France every day, and every Luftwaffe aircraft shot down over France was one less over Kent or Sussex. So there was a trade-off going on here that the RAF was saving its best aircraft for later, but of course it was missing the opportunity to inflict and potentially delay the Battle of Britain later into the year. As it was, the Luftwaffe could not mount the first attacks on England until serious attacks until early August. It took them roughly 6 weeks to replace and repair aircraft and replace their immediate losses and prepare for Eagle Day over England in early August 1940. Heavier losses in France, of course, would have reduced the number of Spitfires available, perhaps, but on the other hand, it would have also reduced the number of Luftwaffe aircraft coming over the channel. So there's a trade-off going on here, and I understand it's easy for post-war historians like myself to say, well, they could have done this, they could have done that. Yes, well, the French were pleading for Spitfires throughout the entire campaign, and it's interesting, the only Spitfires that ever flew over France during the 1940 campaign were at Dunkirk to support the evacuation, and when Churchill flew to Paris, he was escorted one time by Spitfires. But the Dowding and the RAF refused to allow, you know, the best aircraft to be committed, and the French were outnumbered both numerically in the air, and also they had banked on the army being the most important, so they had better tanks than the British, but the British had better fighters than the French. This also begs the question, imagine if the British and French had actually cooperated on sharing military technology 5 years before the war actually began. The British could have benefited from better French technology in terms of riveted armor for their tanks, welded armor for their tanks, better anti-tank guns. On the other hand, the French aircraft industry definitely would have liked the Merlin engine. Just as the war was beginning, the Rolls-Royce made an offer to the French to receive 150 Rolls-Royce engines to re-equip some of their new fighters. Basically, this was kind of too late to make a difference, and I believe a small number were actually license built in France just before the collapse. But one can imagine, what if the French had actually re-equipped some of their fighters with Merlin engines? I mean, that would have...
Yeah.
If you can't send Spitfires, at least send the engines. Yeah.
There's another thing, I guess, with both sides. I was just reading that both sides probably never knew was that the British were outproducing the Germans by enormous amounts when it came to replacing aircraft. With that in mind, that, you know, if they knew that, they might have been more willing, I suppose, to send Spitfires. But you know, it's what you don't know that's the important thing at the time, isn't it?
I think early on, aside from Churchill, I think he was one of the few in the British government or military who believed the French could hang on because of, you know, his impressions from the First War. But I think a large part of the British senior military leadership and some of the political leadership did not believe that the French were in it to win it, and expected them to throw in the towel, and were refused to commit totally to the campaign in France because they didn't expect it to turn out well. And I think that's certainly true of Alan Brooke. And I think that even the RAF was not fully convinced, so they were unwilling to really commit to a European war in a full sense. So I think that was part of the problem.
Well, Brooke seems very disparaging.
From the French point of view, the big shocker, recall that in the First World War in 1918, that Britain had something like 2,000 aircraft on the Western Front and almost 1 million troops. So in 1939, 1940, the French expected something similar. And instead, when they saw 10 divisions show up, they said, you've got to be kidding. And the British 1st Armored Division showed up, and most of the tanks were not equipped. They were equipped with, you know, the Mark VI was equipped with just a machine gun. And they said, you've got to be kidding. Don't you have anything better than this? And Britain had emphasized air power, and they had invested in excellent fighters and a large bomber force. What the French saw was the best fighters were kept in England, and the bombers, for some reason, under Chamberlain, were not bombing Germany. So it looked like Britain's trump cards were being held back from the conflict. Now, when Churchill came in, of course, this changed a little bit, but kind of too late to influence the situation much in France. And they had not prepared to fight. They were hoping it was going to be like 1918 again, that at least England up front would contribute a large force in the air and on the ground, and eventually the United States and other countries would join it as well. So they'd be a coalition effort. They did not get that in 1940, and they weren't ready to bear it on their own in terms of the numbers. I point out repeatedly in the book, I'm not the only historian to do this, but the French soldiers fought very well in 1940, particularly after the initial shocks. They suffered high casualty rates. Many units fought very bravely and suffered heavy casualties. The junior officers, there were plenty of them that showed great panache and heroism and elan on the battlefield. There was not a shortage of that. The problem is they didn't have the equipment. The circumstances they were put into were essentially a no-win situation, not of their creating. And I think they did as well as pretty much any of the other armies did up to about 1942 against the Germans, which is not very well at all.
Well, it's a testament to really actually to the Germans because their casualties were enormous, but they somehow kept going in the face of it. I got the feeling it was much more attritional was the Battle of France than one might be led to expect. You know, the general idea is they're outflanked and whipped in that way. And I got the feeling they actually, in many respects, the Germans got quite a pasting if you look at the casualty figures.
They took some excessive losses. I like to point out that their top fighter pilot, which was Werner Mölders, was shot down and captured. Now, you may recall that Churchill, when he kept flying back to France, kept asking the French, pressing them, that he wanted these 400 captured German flyers turned over to the British. That never actually occurred. Those captured flyers included Werner Mölders and another one of the top Luftwaffe bomber pilots, both of whom were eventually released, recycled, and then used in the Battle of Britain against Britain. Again, the French had managed to shoot down some quality individuals and inflict some serious losses, which, you know, could have set the German war effort back. The Germans had the ability to recover from short-term losses. I mean, even in 1944, it wasn't Montgomery, but it was one of the British generals said that the Germans have an annoying ability to conjure up troops even when they seem to have none left. they always had this ability somehow, like in 1944 when the British army was rolling across Belgium and approaching the Dutch border, and it seemed like there was nothing left. And all of a sudden, in a matter of just days, there's divisions in front of them. Where'd they come from? And you read about some of these ad hoc German formations that were just thrown together. I don't think any other army had the ability in the Second World War to just throw collections of people together. And a lot of times these weren't even just army people. A lot of times they were Luftwaffe ground personnel, Navy personnel. Some of them weren't even German. I mean, these were included POWs from the Soviet Union, the so-called Osttruppen, Eastern troops, people from all over. They would just throw them together into a combat force and achieve fairly remarkable results against, you know, well-led Allied units.
Well, I wondered if the French morale sort of hadn't collapsed because they kind of had this idea that you get the Battle of the Marne in 1914 and the Germans have stopped you from getting too close to Paris. There's Operation Michael in 1918 during the First World War. They stopped. And I wondered if, basically the Allies kind of believed that the Germans must at some point run out of steam in 1940 like they did in the First World War. But as you say, they had somehow an ability to keep going.
Well, there's no doubt the French, particularly Weygand, was counting on that. But the problem is he didn't do what he needed to do to make that happen. So, for example, like you mentioned Michael in 1918. Well, in 1918, they defended Paris. They put up stiff resistance on the last 40 kilometers to Paris. And same in 1914. But they did not do that in 1940. So they had built this ad hoc defense line called the Chavanot Line, which is not even mentioned in most World War II histories. But during the winter, during the Phoney War, they had built some defenses outside of Paris and by an engineer named Chavanot. And Weygand initially said, we're going to defend Paris. And they assigned what divisions they had left to hold the Chavanot Line. And they actually did a pretty good job for a couple days. The problem was, on his own initiative, without consulting the French political leadership, He ordered Paris evacuated, and he did it in a very underhanded sort of way where not everybody was notified. And it's clear that Vagon was doing this to spare civilian casualties in the capital and everything of that sort. But if the Germans had had to fight for Paris, and that's another thing, if the French had mounted a real defense of Paris, there's no doubt in my mind that this would have taken at least 2 weeks for the Germans to deal with. I mean, Warsaw was fully surrounded by the Germans in 1939. It took them more than 2 weeks to eliminate the Polish forces in Warsaw. And I believe that if the French had made an effort to defend Paris with similar number of forces, at least five or six divisions, there's no way the Germans could have dealt with that in less than a couple weeks, which would have bought some additional time. The result, of course, would have been destruction in Paris. Of course, keeping in mind that by 1944, Hitler was ordering the entire city leveled. It's a relative term. What you save today might be destroyed by the invader tomorrow. It's usually best for countries to defend their capital, not just to hand it over to invaders.
Well, I thought when Wagon declares it, you know, an open city and it's not going to be defended, he loses his fallback position, his rallying point. You know, it had been a symbol for the nation in, you know, 1870, 1914, again in 1918. And sort of from that point, it almost appears that the upper echelons of the French military are almost feel defeated rather than necessarily the man on the ground or even the politicians.
Yeah, oh, there's no doubt that at that point, there's a deflation of morale and there's a realization that we're losing the capital and we didn't even fight for it. And most people think of, you know, in their mind, they picture panzers, you know, streaming into Paris and everything. The German actual occupation of Paris was somewhat pathetic. I only used one picture of the actual invasion force, but no tanks were involved, and most of the troops walked in on foot, and a lot of the German horses had already died, and of course the Germans still used over 1 million horses in their army to pull equipment, carts, artillery. They had requisitioned French donkeys at this point and some rather pathetic-looking animals, and you look at some of these pictures of German columns coming in with supply wagons being pulled by French, you know, donkeys that don't look very pretty scrawny looking. And you realize this is it's not the picture of the mighty German, you know, Wehrmacht that you have in your mind. It's another thing I find rather bizarre. I watched some of the it's amazing that French civilians were actually on the street watching the Germans move in. I found that rather peculiar. Women and walking by, you would think most people would be behind doors at that point rather than walking on the Champs-Élysées watching them come down the street. But
I guess it's possibly a sign of the lack of threat that they felt from their own side, if that makes sense. From a French defensive point of view, they must have felt that, you know, no one's going to shoot at the Germans, so they couldn't get any caught in any crossfire. The French government does want to carry on. The Prime Minister, Reynaud, you know, his idea is to carry on fighting from North Africa and the colonies. So what happened to that plan? Why was that quashed?
In essence, there was a military coup aided by Pétain and Wagon and individuals such as Laval, who became the Vichy leader later on. But Reynaud wanted to carry on. A good chunk of the French cabinet and some of the military wanted to carry on as well. The idea being that they would fall back to perhaps Brittany, and make a stand there with what was left of the second BEF. Churchill was all in favor of that idea. He said, we'll provide what support we can to defend Brittany. Was that a good idea? Not really. I don't think a stand could have been made in Brittany for more than a few days, a week at most. But that idea was being toyed with. The real fallback plan was to fall back to Algeria and Morocco and continue the war from there. And Reynaud and most of his ministers at the start believed that was what was going to happen. The problem was every time Reynaud told Vagon, okay, you need to start taking action to make this happen, Vagon always came up with reasons why it couldn't happen and basically never lifted a finger to make it happen. There are a variety of reasons to this. One, Vagon was very conscious of the fact that an armistice was coming in metropolitan France. He was the commander on the spot. He knew that he was most likely the one that was going to have to stay behind and sign the armistice with the Germans. The French commander in North Africa was likely to become the new commander-in-chief of the French army. And this individual was actually in favor of continuing the war as well. And Renan was in discussion with him. Renan connived with Pétain, Laval, and others to undermine Renan by basically adopting a do-nothing attitude when it came to continuing the war in North Africa. They just kept saying, this is can't be done, it won't happen, we won't do anything. Renan should have, at that point, taken the necessary step to fire Vagon. He did not. That was his fatal error. In a democracy, of course, you're in a crisis. Firing your military leader at a point like that seems bad, and most leaders would step back from that point. If you recall, Churchill got rid of Ironside, but he kind of waited till a quiet moment in 1940, and Ironside did not inspire awe in Churchill, and he wanted to get rid of him, but he managed to pick a quiet moment and usher him out, and I can't remember what command he was kicked upstairs to, but I think he was given some honorific position where he could sit out the war and not do any more damage. But Vagon could have been the same thing. They could have elevated him to generalissimo of the Allied armies or something like that, but he needed to go, and a firebrand who would actually continue the war and provide the military leadership is what was missing. And de Gaulle was simply too junior to fill that role, and they needed a four-star general-level officer who could step up, and they did not have it. And the political leadership was basically undermined by essentially a palace coup that robbed them of their ability to use their military at the time. So the military essentially started making decisions for itself.
Yeah, and those high upper echelon members then of the military then all got jobs, no doubt, in the replacement Vichy government.
Yes, they did. Vagon became defense minister. Pétain became the head. In fact, I point out that even while the Third Republic was still breathing, that Pétain was already handing out jobs that would be filled in Vichy to members of the, you know, you're going to get this, you're going to get this. And the old government isn't even dead yet. And he's already giving out positions. It's treason, which is why he was tried for treason after the war. The French could not bring themselves to, you know, carry out a sentence against him. But everybody knew that Vagon and Pétain, that it was treason. In Pétain's case, I think it was partly his advanced age and his kind of sour outlook on life, but he definitely was not the Pétain of 1918, and he had changed there. I think that something else I wanted to get across here, I'm trying to recall, was kind of the whole end of the war period. Of course, Churchill was trying to keep the French in, and Churchill was being undermined as well because Brooke did not follow instructions. Brooke was told, proceed to France, assume command of the 2nd BEF, assist the French as much as you can, hold on as long as you can. If all else fails, save as much British equipment as you can. He did none of that, and he willfully did none of that. He was appointed as head of the 2nd BEF, I believe, on 2 June, just before the fall of Dunkirk. You recall he was evacuated from Dunkirk, recycled, and he was supposed to go back across the Channel. I think he actually got to France on 13 June. He spent 11 days in England before turning around, which was rather leisurely to say he'd been ordered by the cabinet to proceed directly to France, to assume. So for 11 critical days, the troops of the 2nd BEF had no commander. That caused a lot of problems. So you had junior officers like Karslake, Brigadier General Karslake, and a couple Bowman and a couple of the others who were making decisions for themselves, but they were essentially brigadiers. Yeah, they did not have the authority to deal with the French military. So the 2nd BEF was leadership from the beginning. When Brooke did show up, he refused to cooperate with the French and instead cooked up a story that he gave to Churchill in the cabinet that the French are quitting, the war is over, you know, I'm heading home and, you know, all's over. That was actually not completely incorrect. Churchill kept telling him, stay in as long as you can and at least fight a rear guard action so, you know, there's some honor for British troops instead of just running to the ports. And he didn't do any of that. And consequently, a great deal of material was lost. The greatest loss of life for British forces in the campaign was the sinking of the Lancastria, which I think in part is Brooke's fault. He threw together this evacuation in a period of about 72 hours. Even the Dunkirk evacuation, Operation Dynamo, had a little bit more planning than what Brooke did. Brooke just said, we're running for the ports. Let's head for the nearest vessels we can get on. And so you ended up with British large ships like the Lancastria with little or no air support overhead, unlike Dunkirk, which are getting bombed by the Luftwaffe. And you end up with the death toll today is not known on Lancastria. It's at least 3,500. It's potentially as high as 4,000. It was the largest British loss of life in the campaign.
A friend of mine's father was grandfather was plucked off the from the wreckage of the Lancastria.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they saved about 1,500. In fact, French destroyers participated in saving British survivors in the water, who then got on the next British ship and sailed home. And I thought it was interesting that some of the local commanders, I mean, they were even being told to destroy all their equipment on the docks, including brand new trucks, lorries, artillery pieces. One local lieutenant colonel, I believe, disobeyed orders and took his artillery. They took the time to load the artillery. These were some of the few artillery pieces in England, modern artillery, 25 pounders, some of the few 25 pounders in England right after the fall of France in preparation for, you know, Operation Sea Lion. Was they were saved by the action of one junior officer who disobeyed orders from senior. But I make the point, kind of tying in with my Sea Lion book, that the British Army, Brooke made sure that the British Army lost a lot of equipment in France that would have been come in very handy for rebuilding the BEF in England, but it was hastily abandoned, and not to mention millions of gallons of petrol, which were later used by the Germans in their next campaign. It was a hasty and ridiculous retreat because I believe he emotionally rejected the mission. He did not want to do it. He did not want to get stuck with defeat, and it was time to exit. And Churchill's entreaties and orders to him to continue to mount some kind of rearguard action, he just simply ignored and got away with it.
It's a curious mixed message the British are sending when you've got the political leadership saying they're going to, you know, attempt to back them to the hilt, and then at the same time the British military are not sending the RAF squadrons that the French are...
Well, and this played into Renault's fall, because Renault had banked on the Anglo-French alliance. And he kept saying, you know, Churchill says we're going to get help, and Churchill says we're the BEF, the second BEF, and the RAF are going to stay. And then without orders, they're simply leaving. And even Churchill wasn't sure what was going on there for a period of about 24 hours. Of course, defeatists like Vagon are saying, well, look, they can't be trusted. You know, they're just running away. And you know, they said they were going to stay, and they're not. So, of course, that completely undermined Reynolds' position that nobody believed him anymore, because... You know, the aspersions being cast on the Allied alliance seemed true at that point. And a lot of this was due to Brooke's unwillingness to carry out his mission. Again, this is a case of an individual who should have been wrong man for the wrong job. I point out in the book that basically the campaign's outcome was determined by the insubordination of three officers, Guderian, who never obeyed any orders he was getting, Vagon and Brooke. And all three of these, their insubordination affected the outcomes of the campaign. If Guderian had obeyed orders like he was told, he would have halted and given the Allies more time to organize, but he didn't. He never listened to halt orders, so he just kept plowing ahead. He did that again during Case Red. His troops were the first ones to make it to the Swiss border, and Hitler couldn't believe they were already there. You're already there? I told you to stop. It's too fast. You know? he's like, we're already reached the Swiss border.
I hadn't thought of that three officers disobeying orders gives the result of the campaign.
There's a lot of little interesting tidbits that happen at the end of the campaign that just don't see. Like, so one of the French corps that was near the Swiss border at the end, instead of surrendering to the Germans, they marched across the border into Switzerland, and this had The formation had about 40,000 troops, of which I think around 20,000 were Polish, and there were 44 British soldiers in this group. And they were leftovers. The 51st Highland Division, when they were deployed to the Saar front, they had left a few troops behind. And these 44 soldiers, I never were able to find out which unit they were from. They went across the border into Switzerland, were interned, but then Switzerland in 1941 allowed most of these troops to leave via Vichy, France, and then they made their way back to England, including some of the Polish troops too as well. And that's another one of those interesting little things that probably needs some research for a magazine article or something, is to find out who exactly were these troops. And I think there's an interesting story there, you know, about...
Kearsarge largely skipped over in the general historiography of the war. Why do you think it is? Why do we, you know, stop at Dunkirk? I say we. I'm obviously speaking from a British perspective. Does the world stop at Dunkirk?
Yes, I think it pretty much does. Yes, it is an Anglo-centric view to pursue the end at Dunkirk, because Dunkirk is heroic. It was a defeat, but it was heroic. The second BEF is ignominious. They're running for the boats and they're taking heavy losses. And there's no glory. There's no defense of the perimeter like there is at Dunkirk. You have the heroic BEF fighting on the perimeter, holding the line, so you know the troops can stand on the beaches and walk out, you know, to the ships and the little boats and all that. And there's no little boats in the evacuation of the second BEF. It's a rather ignominious story. So I think most countries tend to look over parts of history they don't like or find distasteful. And, you know, the rest of the English-speaking world has taken the British lead on this.
You know, Churchill got his memoirs out quick.
Yes. I mean, you know, the classic history of 1940, of course, is to lose a battle, Alistair Horne. It's excellent. It stops at Dunkirk. I mean, Alistair Horne, you know, basically, I think he mentions Case Red in about 2 pages, and he covers over it very, very quickly. It mostly is talking about the surrender. Incidents like the Lancastria are barely mentioned in most histories of the war.
Well, of course, it was secret, the Lancastria, until the 70s, wasn't it?
There were many incidents such as that. I mean, I think it was the Queen Mary sank a British cruiser during the war. I think it was HMS Curaçao, I believe, and was rammed and sunk during the war with heavy loss of life. And Churchill ordered that kept under wraps. There were several incidents during the war of heavy losses of life that were kept secret because it was thought it would hurt morale. The United States did somewhat the same with Slapton Sands, with the sinking of the landing craft off Slapton Sands.
Issuing of live ammunition.
Yeah, you had 800 American troops killed in one night, you know, and just before D-Day, and that was generally Operation Tiger, I think was the name of that. And that was kept very quiet for a long time. In fact, it wasn't until a few years ago that people realized exactly who those soldiers were. They were engineers, all of them. And what was their wartime mission? Their mission on D-Day was to clear obstacles on beaches, specifically Omaha Beach. So the heavy American casualties on Omaha were in part due to the losses of this one German raid that killed the train engineers just, you know, a couple weeks before the actual D-Day operation, and kind of threw a monkey wrench in the whole plan, you know, for that beach. And these were the trained experts who were going to clear the obstacles, and most of them were killed, you know, in training exercise. And
have the French been complicit in forgetting?
Well, of course, World War II, and particularly 1940, is very complex in history. Now, there are a number of French language histories that are going a long way, and I freely admit to using them as resources. And I did a lot of research in French language sources. You have a number of authors that have been trying to correct the case and point out that the French, particularly the French Air Force, fought very hard and suffered, I think, 45% losses during the campaign. You only had about 800 trained French pilots in May 1940, and roughly 45% of them were killed, captured, or wounded during the campaign. That's pretty heavy losses for 6 weeks. The French Air Force was fighting hard right up to the end, mounting sorties against the Germans and southern France even. But the French, I think, have been trying, but it's very touchy for a number of reasons. The Third Republic fell. It was replaced by a quasi-legitimate government, depending on your point of view, the Vichy government, which is seen as illegitimate by the Anglo-Americans, not so by all Frenchmen, who view perhaps de Gaulle as illegitimate. You know, so you end up with that, who is the legitimate government of France during the war? And then after the war, there's a lot of ugly memories associated with collaboration and all these things. So the Second World War, 1940, I think is being studied intensively in France today, but it's also depends heavily on your point of view in terms of where the emphasis lies and how it is regarded. I think younger French people are very interested in learning more about 1940, and they're learning something different than we're learning from it. I mean, the history of France in the last 100 years is they get invaded relatively frequently, and you know, it usually doesn't turn out too well. They are cognizant of that they need to study this. It's not an academic exercise.
Bob, that's great. I look forward to discussing your next book, Case White, this time next year. If you found that interesting, I can highly recommend you pick up a copy of Case Red, The Collapse of France by Robert Fosick. I think for most people, it will prove to be very thought-provoking on how they view the Battle of France. I'll put a link to the book on the website. If you've not already done so, you can find me on Facebook, WW2Podcast. I do post stuff in support of the latest episode, and it's great to hear your comments and thoughts. So that's it for this episode. All being well, next time out, I'll be looking at the Luftwaffe in Northwest Europe. I'm Angus Wallace, and thanks for listening.
Help your small business thrive and stay connected with the Comcast Business Complete Connectivity Solution. It's the largest, fastest, reliable network. Advanced gig speed Wi-Fi and cyber threat protection. Get started for just $40 a month for 12 months with no annual contract when you add mobile. Plus, ask how to get up to a $750 prepaid card. Comcast Business, powering possibilities.
Ends 2/21/2023. Restrictions apply. Requires Eagle Bill and AutoPay. New 100 megabits per second internet and Comcast Business Security Edge customers only. Equipment taxes and fees extra. After 12 months, regular rates apply. Gig internet required for gig Wi-Fi.